Welcome back to Minds Matter, a podcast sponsored by the Monash Center for Consciousness and Contemplative Studies. I'm Ava.
And I'm Beth. And on Minds Matter, we explore research from psychology to neuroscience while occasionally talking through our own personal experiences.
This week on the podcast, I spoke to Dr. Razia Sahi, who is currently a postdoc at Princeton and an incoming assistant professor at Rutgers Newark in the psychology department there. And today we talked about Razia's work on emotion regulation, specifically the idea that emotion regulation isn't just something that is kind of internal. So when you think about emotion regulation, you think about different strategies that you might have heard of, like trying to reframe your thoughts and trying to maybe distance yourself from your own thoughts. But really the core questions that we look at today is about when we actually don't do this kind of inside our own heads, but when we're actually doing this in a shared experience. So asking other people to help us regulate our emotions and how we do this. There are different strategies. We'll talk about validating someone else's feelings. We'll also talk about how other people help us to reframe and how maybe holding hands with someone can really make a difference and in what ways it makes a difference.
My name is Razia Sahi. I am a postdoctoral fellow right now at Princeton University and an incoming faculty member at Rutgers Newark starting next year. I study social emotion regulation, so how people regulate each other's emotions. And there's a lot to unpack there, so I'm just going to say that much for now and hope we can get into the definition more.
Can you give us a definition of emotion regulation in general, how it's been studied in the self, and maybe why you wanted to look at how it's studied socially?
So emotion regulation is just the process of managing how we experience and express our emotions. And this is thought to be extremely important because even though emotions are really normal, they're functional, they're helpful, they help us get through life, and they're a very normal part of life. If they become too large or too long, they can get in the way of our everyday functioning. They can get in the way of us reaching our goals, get in the way of our relationships, and ultimately be harmful to our mental health if they're completely dysregulated. And so emotion regulation is something that we all do every day, which is the little sort of things that we do to control, manage, change, even maintain our emotional experiences within ourselves and how we're expressing them to the people around us. And the reason that I got really interested in studying this from a social perspective is because I think that in everyday life, a lot of times when we're figuring out how we're going to manage the way that we're feeling and how we're going to try to modify our emotional states in order to get through things, we lean on the people around us, and that even sometimes without leaning on them, they come to us seeing that there is an emotional need. And I felt that social support was really absent in how people study emotion regulation specifically and a lot of the key concepts in the literature. And so I wanted to start to integrate this sort of social perspective into the way we think about and study emotion regulation by, for example, bringing in dyads to the lab to study the same types of emotion regulation processes we study on individuals, but start to study them in pairs of people, like friends, couples, or even in clinical therapy.
I think that walks us right into the first study that we'll talk about. So in one study, you test the effects of social reappraisal in terms of comparison groups with passive viewing, self-regulation, but also social regulation. Could you tell us a little bit about that study, what it found, and also the immediate versus enduring effects that you looked at?
Yeah, so in that work, that was my sort of entryway into studying some of these concepts that I'm interested in. So there, I specifically targeted reappraisal as the point of entry because reappraisal is considered to be an extremely effective strategy for regulating our emotions. So reappraisal is when you change how you're thinking about your emotional experiences to change how you're feeling. So an example would be, it's not that bad, or this won't last forever, or trying to find a silver lining. And so again, this is thought to be really effective. It's something that we all do every day on our own all the time. I think it's something that is also actually the foundation of clinical therapy in some way. So things like cognitive behavioral therapy use a lot of reappraisal. And reappraisal has been shown to track with mental health really robustly. So it's really widely studied. It's probably the most widely studied emotion regulation strategy out there. But it's almost always studied in the context of somebody changing their own mind to change how they're feeling. And I've just already laid out an example for you of people getting help with this, clinical therapy. A lot of times when we do reappraisal, we don't do it alone. We get perspectives from the people around us. We get nudges. We get support to do this. And so why aren't we studying it in the lab that way? So with this research, I actually had friend pairs come into the lab, and one person was trying to regulate and the other person was helping with that regulation. And so what we had them do is they split off randomly into the experiencer. So this is the person regulating and the helper. And the experiencer did two types of tasks. One was the solo emotion regulation task. So here they had reappraisal by themselves, really classic. You see a picture, you come up with a story about how it's not that bad, and you make a rating. And of course, they have control conditions. They're also looking at and rating negative and neutral images. And then they also did a social task. And of course, these were counterbalanced. And in the social task, they did the exact same thing. But this time, when they were reinterpreting, they were actually listening to the friend reinterpret the stimulus for them. So they'd see an image, they'd see the cue to listen, and they'd hear their friend through headphones reappraising the image. And so through this task, we wanted to, again, just really tightly control everything except for where the reappraisal came from. And what we found is that when your friend reappraises for you, it's actually leading to better emotion regulation outcomes. So there was lower negative affect for the images that were being socially regulated as compared to those that were solo regulated. And of course, we did several control studies as well to make sure this wasn't a difference in the quality of the reappraisals. It wasn't just a social buffering effect. So we had social baseline conditions as well. So there's really something particular and special that happens when you combine social support with reappraisal in terms of how well it can help regulate emotion. And here we also wanted to see whether this effect actually lasted beyond the immediate moment of support. So there we conducted another study. So this is a total of four different studies, where in the final study, we had experiencers look at the same images from the task that they did again a day later. They didn't know they were going to see these images again. And as they looked at the images, their only job was to passively rate them now. So they would see an image and they'd rate it. And so they're just responding based on their gut impressions. And what we found with that work is that the images that were previously socially regulated, so meaning images where they had heard their friend reinterpret it, those were now associated with lower negative affect, both than the ones that they had solo regulated and images that had not been regulated at all. So this suggests that when we get social support with something like reappraisal, its effects actually go beyond the moment that you're actively receiving support to just linger and help you process these events, even as you experience them again in the future by yourself.
Those findings are so cool. The friend, when they were doing the reappraisal, were they told this is for your friend, or it was just reappraise it in general?
Yeah, so they knew. So they knew what their roles in the study were. They didn't know before they came in that day. They're randomly assigned. But once they were split, we told them together at the same time, you're going to regulate and you're going to help with that. And yeah. So the person who was receiving the help knew their friend was trying to help. And the person who was helping knew their job was to help. And we actually also went in and ended up analyzing the acoustics of the person who was providing support. And that was in part because we knew that they knew that their job was to help. And we wondered, as we were listening to them really make these recordings, wow, some of them are really putting a lot of effort into the way they sound to make these clips really effective and sound realistic for their friend. They understood their jobs. And we ended up finding some interesting patterns with the acoustic work as well, suggesting again that people were well aware of what their roles were. And again, with some of the control conditions that we had later on, they were also told your job is to help, but it wasn't as effective as the intervention for reappraisal.
Super interesting. So that kind of suggests that it's not just you're not going through it alone, but it's really that magic combination of reappraisal plus doing it with someone else.
Exactly. Yeah. And that was a really important control study that we had to make sure that it wasn't just hearing your friend talking is just better than doing something by yourself.
So people might also be wondering about other strategies for reappraisal and also social reappraisal, and might be thinking about the types of emotion regulation that they like to receive from their friends and thinking maybe it's not reappraisal. And in other studies, you've actually looked at the different strategies that people really do use when they're not being instructed by a researcher to do a specific type of emotion regulation. So what has your research found in terms of how people talk to each other when giving support and how these different methods are received by different targets?
Yeah, I love this question. It's a nice sort of bridge from the work that we've done into the real world, right? Like in the real world, you don't always reappraise, and reappraisal may not always work the way that you intended it to work, even though it might be really effective and research shows that. What do people actually do? So to start to get at this question, we conducted a study where we used participants' own autobiographical experiences as stimuli. And we thought this was particularly important because we think that reappraisal, despite, again, being really helpful and being shown to be really effective, it can be tricky in real life because when you challenge someone's own perspective of their experiences, it can actually come across as invalidating, it can create resistance to support and have the opposite effect of what was intended. And so we wanted to start to think about, again, when you're really actually upset about something that's personal to you, what is it you want to hear? Do you want a reappraisal? And how do we compare different strategies there? So we were specifically interested in reappraisal in that study, but we also included another strategy called validation. And with validation, you're not trying to change how someone's thinking at all. All you're doing is showing them that there's space for their emotional experience and kind of confirming that their experience makes sense and that you might feel similarly. So an example would just be to say something like, that would bother me too. That's super upsetting. I would be upset as well. So we had in this study, people come in and share a personal experience, a current stressor, something like a conflict in their lives. And first they gave feedback to other people. And when I say other people, I mean a confederate. They all read the same story by somebody else. And they got a list of feedback items to choose from. And that list was just one sentence feedback items. They were pretty generalizable. And we told them, pick one item that you want to send to this person. So they picked an item and they sent it to that person. I'll come back to what we found in that part in a second. But after they picked that item, then they received feedback from several other people about their own experience. And by several other people, again, we chose that feedback for them. There was no other people. But they believed there were other people because they had just had to choose from this list as well. So they believed that other people were choosing from a list of one sentence feedback items and that they were getting real feedback from real people about their experience. And that feedback that they got ranged from validating items to reappraisal items. And within reappraisal, we looked at several different types of reappraisals because in real life, again, there's not a one size for reappraisals. There's also different ways to do it. So we had, for example, temporal distancing. So focusing on the impermanence of the current situation. So an example is, this may be bad now, but it's not always going to be this way. They also had reappraisals that focused on the bright side. So things like trying to focus on the positive things in life. And then there was perspective taking. So trying to get people to zoom out of their current experience. So things like trying to see both sides of the situation. And these are all reappraisals, but as you can tell, they do the reappraisal a little differently. So participants receive feedback from all of these different reappraisal types and validation. And then we asked them how comforting was different items of questions they got at, how comforting the feedback was, how helpful they thought the feedback was, and how much they preferred the feedback. And what we found is that validation was always the most preferred over the reappraisals. But when you look at helpfulness, validation is not thought to be more helpful than reappraisals. And in fact, when we look closely at the reappraisals themselves, temporal distancing was seen as the most comforting of the reappraisals and was seen as more helpful than any other reappraisal and not significantly different for validation. But nonetheless, when you look at preference for feedback, their preference was for validation, followed by temporal distancing and so on. So this suggests that what people prefer, what they want, at least when they're just going to get one type of feedback only, they want the validation. They want to feel understood. And I think if you connect this with other research that's been done in this space, what we see is that validation is important for creating a sort of understanding and a shared experience that can then open the door for things like reappraisal. You need that sort of baseline in order to move forward into starting to change your perspective.
So in this study, the participants were talking to people that they didn't know yet. Is that right?
That's right. This is all strangers. So I mentioned that they all gave feedback in the beginning to somebody else. Again, not a real person, but they all gave feedback to someone else's story. One thing that we found that was really interesting there is that even though all of our participants, study one was 50 people, study two was 200 people, all of our participants read the exact same study. And yet there was quite a spread in terms of what strategy they chose to give another person. And when we looked at the relationship between the feedback they chose to give other people and the feedback that worked best for them, we actually found that these were associated. So this suggests that there are these sort of individual differences, at the very least in this sort of model of what people think is going to be helpful feedback. And that probably stems from what they prefer to receive themselves.
Yeah, that makes sense. People like to anchor on their own experiences. So was there any other type of like individual difference pattern that you could pick out? Did you measure anything like personality traits or anything like that?
Yeah, so we looked at several different sort of individual differences there. First off, we looked at gender. This is in part because we do find gender effects in other studies with social reappraisal. And so we wanted to see what we found here. Results were a little bit inconsistent, but we found mixed evidence for the idea that men were more open to and enthusiastic about reappraisal than women. Women were more leaning towards validation. Again, mixed evidence there. We also looked at several different questionnaire measures. So here we just threw a lot at them, and then we did a factor analysis to see like what are the sort of general personality differences that we're seeing in the study that might track with something. And there we ended up with two sorts of main clusters. And the first was more along the lines of need for affirmation. So this tracked with things like anxious attachment or rejection sensitivity and things like that. And for people like that, validation was more important. Again, the evidence here was mixed. The only thing that was consistent across our two samples was really that your own choice of providing support to others is tracking with what ultimately works for you.
So when you were talking about the study, and also because they're talking to strangers, I was thinking that there's like kind of two goals in a way in this situation. If you're the person, I guess both receiving and giving the feedback, is maybe regulating the person's negative emotion, but then also wanting them to maybe like you or maybe advance a relationship in some type of way, in the sense of maybe a friendship, or at least get them to think that you're not a bad person.
That's a really interesting question in thinking about what is the goal of the person who's offering this regulatory support to someone else. I do think that there are relational goals. So there are goals that you have about the relationship with this person. And then there are maybe goals that are more focused, again, on the affective outcomes for the person receiving support. So I think that there is research out there to suggest that reappraisal is better for long-term recovery. It works better, it sticks better than something like validation, which just makes people feel good in the moment. And so if you're focused on affective outcomes or regulatory outcomes, then you might be focused more on offering reappraisal. But of course, there's also research to suggest, including some of the work we just discussed, that people really want to feel understood. They feel good. And when someone feels good when they're talking to you, they're likely to want to keep talking to you. Of course, there is a sort of relational motivation there to validate people. I think that within this study, interestingly enough, even though it makes sense that especially if you don't know someone, reappraisal may not be the go-to move, we still saw quite a bit of people choosing reappraisal to offer to this stranger. Again, they all read the exact same study and still many of them chose reappraisal. So I think that it would be interesting to inquire that whether like they were thinking about affective outcomes versus sort of relational outcomes. I think in this case, because it's strangers, there's really no, it's not coming back to them at all. They have no idea who this person is. They're never going to meet them and they know this. I think that the goals probably vary a lot and that could explain some of these outcomes. But I think also we probably maintain both relational and affective goals. So maybe, for example, if you're close to somebody, even though you want them to like you and think well of you and want to keep talking to you, if you care about them, you also want them to do better. So I really think in daily life, people are probably going to be using a combination of strategies. And I think the order and the sort of grace with which you can do both is going to shape both relational and affective outcomes.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. I'm wondering if that could be also part of why you see the difference between men and women is like maybe women are a little bit more worried either about the relational goals, but even if they're strangers, maybe it's something about like preserving an image of like, oh, I'm a nice person, like I'm a girl's girl or whatever it is.
Yeah.
Whereas men are more like, there's a problem at hand that I'm trying to solve and I'm never going to see you again, so I don't care. So
yeah, I think that's really interesting. And I think when I think about the gender differences that I find in some of this work, some of it makes me think of exactly what you just said. So there are different sort of relational goals. There's different sorts of self-preservation of image and things like that. But there's also just differences in friendships. And so in some of the work where I find these gender differences, we're looking at men friendships and women friendships. And there are just like known differences in the types of friendships that people have, the extent to which they talk about their emotions, they express their emotions, create space for emotions, or even are seeking emotional support as opposed to problem solving. So there's a lot to unpack there, and there's probably a lot of overlap between some of those gender differences and starting to think about sociocultural norms more broadly and thinking about how those relate.
I loved this episode, and as Emotional Girl 101, I feel like I'm constantly regulating with my friends. So I related to this episode a lot, and I'm going through a big grief at the moment from a loss, which I know will like never go away. but it's like the initial processing and shock. But during this period of grief, I have been cry screaming with anyone who's up for it. And it's been amazing. I've been crying at the coffee shop. I've been crying with people in the lab, with my housemates. I was crying with one of the professors at Monash, and then they started crying about their own grief they've experienced because it is a universal feeling. And basically, when I listened to this episode, I was like, yeah, having someone else there for that emotion processing and regulation and validation, I can't imagine not having that. So I definitely understand everything that was found in the studies. I was like, yeah, I get it.
I like that you also said that you've done this with every type of relationship. Strangers, yeah. Coffee shop people, your boss, professor, best friends. Like, that was one of the questions that I had for Razia just generally about this research was, is it the same depending on who is there with you? And I think you are really proof of this works so well, and it works so much better than being on your own, which I think was such an interesting finding. Like, literally just being there and just a stranger helping you regulate does so much more than just you being on your own. But I think it's interesting that for you, it's like anyone. It's like social other.
My auntie was like, are you just going around like triggering all of Brunswick? She's like, are they okay with going there with you? And like, you know, fair point. I've felt like everyone's been happy to, like, I'm not just, I don't know, they might listen to this and be like, no, it was terrible. But I have felt like everyone's being okay with, that's what I always find, actually. People have this feeling of, oh, expressing a raw emotion isn't the right thing to do, but then you do it. And I don't know, it always does seem like the right thing to do. And people connect with it and understand it. And, you know, they can support you, and then you can also support them in another time too. Like, it goes both ways. And
I mean, I think one, that's your optimism. Because I think a lot of people, you know, they have these like quite cynical views of the world and of other people and how people will react to them. And I think you just have such a model in your brain of other people as wanting to care and wanting to engage in a type of relationship with you that isn't just tit for tat exchange, but is really like, you'll be there for me and I'm going to be there for you. But I think that's so beautiful that you're doing that.
And I thought it was interesting, the validation versus regulation is, and I was thinking Ava and I, our relationship is definitely validation. But then I also feel like when one of us is truly spiraling and it is no longer connected to reality whatsoever, then I think the other person can be like, all right, let's get to the facts here. I definitely feel like I've been in moments of true spirals and you've been able to do more regulation, be like, hey, Beth, like, this is terrible, but you know, this is the reality as well, which is, I'm glad.
Yeah, this is something that we talked about in the interview as well, is when you're regulating with someone else, there's two types of goals, right? There's making the other person feel better, but then there's also the relational context and wanting to make sure that our friendship is still strong and for you to not just feel better, but to know that I'm there for you and that we're there for each other. Maybe there's three components, like making someone feel better in the moment, making sure your relationship is also strong, but then also long-term trying to value their welfare and reframe things as necessary as maybe they might need long-term. And I don't think this has happened that much with you, but you know, sometimes with like dating, I feel like there are situations in which, you know, well, I'll talk to our friend and be like, girl, you were so wrong for that. Like, you shouldn't have done that. But you know, you're like, yeah, he was crazy or she was the worst. Like, that was not you. That was all them. But ultimately, you know, like, well, first of all, this is good for our relationship for me to be validating you because I got your back, loyalty, but also this is the wrong relationship for you anyway. So even if you kind of made the mistake, this is, the dynamic is bad. So I think those competing goals kind of influence, especially in a closer relationship, the way that people probably choose to regulate, because there's so many different things that you could be trying to do with that regulation. And I think definitely number one, with Beth, I think number one is always validate. And then we can... then we can talk about the rest.
It is number one, validate. That is
So one of the findings also was that people like other people to do the strategies that they like, and they do the strategies that they like for others. So do you feel like you also match the type of regulation that you do to other people for like what you would want yourself?
Don't you feel that I am a validator?
Yeah, you're definitely a validator. I think another really interesting aspect is trying to figure out what a person actually wants to feel in this situation, because I think that can vary so much as well. One of my favorite studies is the study that looked at the types of bereavement cards that people like to receive and want to send. So, okay, picture them. So there's one card that is kind of yellowy. It has like some like nice cartoon flowers on it, like a pretty drawing. And it says something like, the power of the memories will keep your hope alive and they'll always be with you through the warmth of the memories, right? The warmth of the memories will always keep you together and okay. And the other card is black and white, and it's a picture of a white rose that's wilting. And it says something like, there will be never be any words to express the depth of the sadness. Those are the two greeting cards. Think about the cards, listeners. Beth, Beth has already made her decision. Which one would you choose to send someone, and which one would you prefer to receive?
I mean, both the colorful one.
Agree.
Right? Yeah, okay.
Okay, I think right is like, that's, I think like that's exactly where I was. I first heard about this in a lecture. Birgit Kolbman-Holm does this research, and she came to give a talk. And I was sitting in the front row of this talk, so I couldn't see people behind me, right? So she shows these two cards, and then she's like, okay, which one would you choose? And, you know, I put my hand up or whatever, and I hadn't looked back. And she was like, okay, like, pretty even split. And I'm like, even split?
What?
Like, making exactly the same face as Beth. I'm like, what psychopath would choose the second dark card? I turn around, who is it but my husband choosing the second card? And basically, it was every non-Australian North American was choosing the second card. And they were all looking back at all the Americans with the same, like, what is wrong with you? And it was a jarring for me because it was like my own partner was like, that's so weird. You would really choose that card. And I've talked to my parents, who neither of them are American, North American. Both of them are like, that first card is psychotic, the flower one.
What?
Like, I don't want anyone to tell me the power of my memories. That's so inappropriate. I'm upset. Why would you want to take away from the fact that I've just lost someone and pretend that everything's fine? And so I think this is really interesting because these cultural differences, but I think also personal differences in the kind of ideal affect in some cases, but like, and that's kind of like more generally for the types of emotions that you want to feel in life. But with the way, especially that people deal with negative emotions, there are certain cultures in which you want to just move on, you want to be happy, and you want to see the positive immediately in things. But in other cultures, like in Europe, in Asia as well, you sit with that negative emotion. And it's weird to want to immediately turn it positive. And so I think also understanding what the other person really wants to feel in that time, because if you message me and you say, I went through this huge loss, I know that I want to say it's okay for you to be upset. But I know that immediately you also want something like, she'll be with you forever. You know, in some ways, it's not actually like the loss it feels like, but of course you can feel upset, but you also should feel happy and joyful for what happened. You know, the don't cry because it's over, smile because it happened. I feel like that's really how our culture thinks of these things. And so for emotion regulation socially, you kind of also need to know what that other person kind of wants. And I was so shocked to see my closest other like want something. So, and my parents, like literally the three closest people in my life, all would have chosen a different card and would not have wanted me to send them that card. And I was like, wow, I'm so ill-attuned.
I right? can't, honestly, I'm shocked. Because also in Australia, it can be quite common for people to ask you not to wear blacks for a funeral. So sending a wilted flower?
I'll post them on our website so you can see. It's a rose that's on a table or on the ground, and like the flowers, the petals are coming off and it's wilting. And like at first I thought it was like a roll of toilet paper of someone crying like with the toilet paper.
Your mom and your dad all would send that.
Yes. And they all thought the other one was weird and wildly inappropriate. And Razia didn't look at any cultural differences, you know, and maybe the scenarios were also different, but it kind of just makes me think, like, in these very specific types of situations, like maybe bereavement, what do you prefer? And is it kind of dictated by culture or just the ways in which you want to deal with these negative emotions? And to be a good social regulator, how much do we have to know that? How much do we have to be thinking about that?
I can't stand tough love.
No one is surprised.
I don't think it's love. Oh, I hate it. Oh, anyway. So,
and everyone who's going to be regulating Beth as she runs around Brunswick,
right, screaming,
no tough love.
No tough love.
So one of the things that you touched on was that there's nonverbal ways of regulating people's emotions. Like, you talked a little bit about vocal pitch, which we'll talk about in a second. But another way of comforting someone is by giving physical touch. I think a lot of this could deviate into like love language stuff, which, curious about your thoughts about that, because like your research does seem like it's about understanding what another person wants, if you want to also have those relational goals, but also maybe make them feel better. Anyway, actually, what do you think about love languages? Let's just side note a bit.
Yeah, love languages. Oh, fascinating. Okay, so what do I think about love languages? I think, honestly, that... Okay, can we first like name all of them just so we have them all in mind?
Yeah.
What are all the... So there's like words physical of affirmation, physical touch,
gifts.
Acts of service.
Yes.
Gifts. Okay.
And quality time.
Quality time. Okay. Yeah. So honestly, I think all of us need all of these in the same way that all of us need all of the emotion regulation strategies. But... our preferences are probably shaped by a lot of different things, including our habits, including norms for who we are and what we think we can expect of people and all of that stuff. So when we think about physical touch, I think one thing that's interesting is that we don't find gender differences in that study. So in that work in particular, where we used affective touch or consoling touch, where you're consoling someone, consoling a distressed individual through an act of physical contact, this can be handholding, hugging, all kinds of things. Here we specifically targeted couples because, of course, receiving touch from someone who's not your romantic partner can be complicated. There's a lot of individual differences there and cultural norms and all kinds of things. And so we looked at romantic couples where touching is often a norm. And so here we looked at one person reliving some of their worst memories. Actually, we used like very strong stimuli. These are experiences of betrayal, loss, loneliness. These are some of their deepest memories. And they come in, they videotape themselves talking about these memories. So very salient to watch yourself telling one of these stories. And then they come back and, again, watch these videos with their partner. And they're either holding a squeeze ball or they're holding their partner's hand. And they have a curtain between them. There's no contact, no talking, no nothing outside of the touch. But they know their partner is always there. And what we found there is that while watching these videos, there was no change in distress from holding their partner's hand. They didn't feel less bad. Okay, and less bad is the normal sort of metric of these emotion regulation tasks that I use. But they felt more comforted, meaning they felt more good, right? So feeling good and feeling bad can come apart. These things can change independently of each other. And I think what was the most interesting there is that we actually found this lasting effect. When we asked participants later by email, how bad do you feel when you think about this memory now? They reported lower emotional pain for the videos that were previously paired with handholding. But again, we're not cueing them to what videos were paired with handholding. This is just how they felt later. And that was a bit of an exploratory finding. So, of course, we did the study again and we replicated this effect. And so here we found that during the intervention, so meaning when they're holding hands, no change in pain. A week later, the memories that they were previously paired with handholding are now, we're seeing lower pain for those memories. So there's a sort of spooky effect that happens where, you know, just because you're touching during this time, again, their partner's always there. They could have talked about all these memories together. They know exactly what happened. But by holding your partner's hand, something happens that allows you to process that memory over time. And so the way that I square this with a lot of my other research is that, again, people don't always need a reappraisal. Sometimes what they need is space to deal with something that's really complicated. And this handholding is acting as another sort of tool, I think, for creating comfort. In the same way that validation creates comfort, increases positive affect, increases feelings of safety. And I think those feelings of safety that could allow us to adaptively process things that are really challenging in a way that potentially even updates memories. And this is a mechanism that we're actually testing with neuroimaging work right now to see if there's a little bit of a memory updating process that happens when you receive this type of support when coping with something challenging from your past. I didn't connect that to love languages at all. But basically, I think, again, no gender differences there. So I think that we're all these squishy mammals that like really need a lot of different kinds of support. And some things are really intrinsically valuable. And I think touch is one of those things.
Also, would be really interesting to think about if it was a different type of relationship, because I think there's also a lot of research about like how a lot of men, because they don't have those close emotional bonds with friends, that they kind of put all of their emotional eggs in that basket of the close relationship. So it'd be interesting to see like other relationships too.
Completely. Actually, that bridges really well into the acoustic study. I don't know if that's where you wanted to go.
Yeah, let's go.
Okay. Okay. Interestingly there, we looked across three samples to see what acoustic patterns were mapping onto reappraisal success, social reappraisal success specifically. And we found across these three samples that were predominantly women. I'm going to touch on men, but these are predominantly women. And what we find is that higher pitch, higher speaker pitch, when I'm supporting you and I use higher pitch when I'm offering reappraisals, that was associated with better affective and relationship outcomes. So that means that as a target of support, if you're using higher pitch when you're using those reappraisals, I'm reporting lower negative affect when I'm doing the task. And it means that when I ask you how satisfied are you with your friend, just generally speaking, I'm reporting more satisfaction for people when those support givers are using higher pitch during the task. So super fascinating, again, associated with affective and relationship outcomes. But what we found that's interesting, and this is just preliminary because we only had one sample of men to look at there, we found that these patterns were not present in men, such that it looked like either there's no association between vocal pitch and these affective outcomes in men, or that it has the inverse effect. Higher pitch means worse emotion regulation outcomes in the social context for men. And part of the way that we're explaining that is because of what you just said. There's a lot of research to suggest that men will elevate their pitch in a lot of social contexts. So, for example, when they're talking to babies, when they're talking to their pets, when they're talking to their romantic partners, this sort of baby talk is a common thing and is associated with things like higher pitch. Men do this. But you know who men don't do this with? Their friends. Men do not baby talk with their friends. Women do baby talk with their friends. Women do elevate their pitch when they're having an exciting conversation and it communicates positive affects and it facilitates bonding and all of these different things. And so I think this really underscores your point nicely, which is that if you look across relationships, we can learn more about where these gender differences are coming from. Is it about something about the receiver or is it about the relationships and the norms? I almost always think it's about the norms and not about, you know, some innate differences in terms of what we actually like and need.
That's so interesting. And I guess I'm wondering what you think about that, because to me, that's, I don't know, that makes me feel sad for the men who are like not able to regulate with their friends.
So actually, I wish I could just show you a figure right now of what we found. But when we look at the sort of nuances of some of these gender findings, particularly again for these social reappraisal studies, what we find is that social reappraisal was effective for men, and so was solo reappraisal. And if you compare how effective social reappraisal was for men and how effective social reappraisal was for women, just those two sort of bars, no difference. Really, where we see the difference is between self and social, which means that social reappraisal is effective for men. They're just not getting the relative advantage that women are getting. It doesn't serve as an intervention in the way that it does for women in terms of improving reappraisal outcomes. So again, I think this goes back to like men benefit from this, but how often do they use it? And are they using it in their regular lives? Is this something that amongst their sort of relationships with other men, their friendships with other men, is a norm? I think these are all questions that are important to ask, but again, it underscores the idea that these socially facilitated emotion regulation strategies are effective kind of no matter who you are, but how effective they'll be might be impacted by some of these external factors. We also did look at emotional reactivity in that study to see, like, are men just less reactive than women? There's a lot of mixed literature on all of that. They were slightly less reactive, but not so much so that it changed anything so dramatically. It was significant, don't get me wrong, but all of the other sort of comparisons were the same. And so I think, again, is that related to what they think they're allowed to say about how reactive they are to emotional things? It's hard to say. I think there's a lot more to parse out there. And the reason I think that we see all of this mixed evidence, again, across all of these studies, sometimes you see really obvious gender differences in reactivity or reappraisal or social support. Sometimes they're not there. I think it's, again, because there's a spectrum. There is not a binary that makes it really easy to examine these differences. I truly believe that people are all over the map when it comes to reactivity, support, expression and that we should think about, again, cultural norms and other sources of variability outside of ourselves, too, that are shaping and influencing the way that these processes ultimately unfold.
Yeah, I was going to ask, because it feels like it's not just about being a man or a woman. Like, I think in other cultures, you would find completely different things. But what that third variable is, because I'm sure there's women who would be like that prototypical male response. But I guess because there are all these norms and all these kind of social structures that we have to live in and grow up in, that there probably isn't that third variable. And maybe that's why there's so much movement across different studies that show like sometimes it's reactivity, sometimes it's something else. So it seems like you have your work cut out for you.
Definitely do. Yeah, I would love some collaborators who do work in terms of culture norms and display norms and things like that who could help me better understand what's going on. I think a lot of the, almost all of the work that I show is always going to be not true for some groups. And that includes, like you're saying, different parts of the world. And I think that just gives us more to study. I think that just makes it more interesting.
Yeah, that would be so cool. And maybe you can tell us a little bit about your postdoc work, give a little preview to what's coming out.
Sure. Yeah, I would love to. Okay, so when I started my postdoc here, I was really excited because there were two sorts of amazing next steps that I could take in one place, in one project that I'd always wanted to take and that could only really be done in certain kinds of labs. And this was the perfect lab to do it. So I'm working with Eric Nook, and he's a clinical psychologist, and he's an expert on language and emotion. And so when you think about social emotion regulation, first of all, I think clinical therapy readily comes to mind, right? This is a place where people are regulating each other. One person in particular is responsible for regulating another person, and it's thought to be really effective, and these people are trained on how to do it. So how could I study social emotion regulation without thinking about therapists? So I was really excited to come into a lab where we have this data set of psychotherapy transcripts of over a million text messages back and forth between clients and therapists, where this is what they're doing psychotherapy and I can analyze it. Perfect next step in terms of context. And in terms of methods, one thing that I was really excited to do here was to start to incorporate NLP methods. And the reason for that is because I think I'm very curious about the sort of subtle ways that we regulate each other. It's one thing to say, oh, we validate, oh, we reappraise, but how are we really doing that? And what are some of the ways that we can measure that in really naturalistic conversations, which is what these are. These are just completely unscripted transcripts, fully naturalistic data set. So I want to start thinking about these more sort of subtle mechanisms for conveying the same types of sort of strategies and support that I've been interested in. And Eric has done a lot of this sort of psycholinguistic work. And so I got to work with this data set and learn about psycholinguistic methods. And we decided to target people's emotion vocabularies as a potential source of information on social emotion regulation. So emotion vocabularies, in particular in the way that we operationalized it and studied it, it refers to the diversity of emotion words that people are spontaneously producing in their interactions. And so, again, this is not the frequency. This is not a sort of sentiment score. This is trying to get at the diversity of words they're bringing up as they're talking. And here we wanted to look at the client language and also the therapist language. Now, on the client side, there's a lot of work out there to suggest that using really precise language is really important for emotion regulation. So, for example, people with alexithymia who have a hard time putting their feelings into words are known to have worse mental health. There's a lot of research on emotion differentiation and granularity and how those things can facilitate emotion regulation. So the client side, there's a lot of reason to want to study something like the diversity of emotion words people are using to try to get at this concept of precision. And again, it's an open question. Do those two things track together, emotion vocabularies and this type of linguistic precision? Especially, again, we're thinking about naturalistic text here. And then on the therapist side, very little psycholinguistic research has been done to tell us what do people say and how do they say it in these sort of nuanced linguistic ways that help regulate other people's emotions. And so there we wanted to look at emotion vocabularies, again, as a window into, are they using really precise language to, for example, model what it's like to use precise language for others? Or are they doing it to communicate specificity in what they're hearing to help validate? Or are they using it to create cognitive change? What's going on there? And so when we looked at this data, and this is, we split it, we have exploratory and validation subsets. These are very large data sets. When we look at it, we decompose into within person and between person components, again, because we have enough data to do this. And within person is going to tell us whether changes in emotion vocabulary across therapy are actually tracking with mental health outcomes. And between person variability there is going to tell us more about whether it's more about an individual differences story. So what we found is that on the client side of things, we didn't find any within person associations. So variation in how clients are using emotion vocabulary across psychotherapy is not tracking with their mental health. But we did find consistent between-person associations. So clients who were using larger negative and larger positive emotion vocabularies, they're reporting fewer internalizing symptoms. So this is at least in line with a sort of individual differences account of people who use a larger variety of emotion words are doing better. How and why, we don't know. We didn't find these within-person associations. Okay, now putting that aside, we get to, I know, it creates a lot to think about just on the client side of things. But when you get to the therapist now, here we find within-person associations. So as therapists are using larger negative and larger positive emotion vocabularies, their clients are reporting fewer internalizing symptoms with slight differences there across exploratory validation subsets. Okay. Why? Why would larger therapist emotion vocabularies be tracking with client mental health in this way? Again, this suggests a mechanism, a treatment mechanism. We think it actually aligns really well with a lot of the research I've already done. When people use a large variety of negative emotion words, we think, and this we specifically found this effect for negative emotion vocabulary in early therapy. Early therapy is when therapists are building rapport with their clients. They're developing therapeutic alliance with their clients. And this lays the foundation for effective, for example, cognitive change later on. So this aligns with what I shared earlier about validating people, showing them that you understand what they're saying. So we think people are, therapists in particular, are using these specific emotion words to help communicate to their clients that they're listening and understanding what their client is saying. And that this, again, is really important for that rapport building stage. Now, when it comes to therapist positive emotion vocabulary, we found associations with that, with client mental health across therapy. So we think what's happening there is a sort of behavioral activation. So when therapists are using a large variety of positive emotion words, we think that this is helping them get their clients to engage with a greater range of positive emotional experiences in their daily lives. So they'll say things like, that's so exciting. You must be so proud. Things like that, really specific emotion words to get them to see all of these positive experiences and to get them to engage with them. And again, this is more of a sort of cognitive form of emotion regulation. You're trying to help them broaden their experiences and doing this in part by drawing on different emotion concepts through words. And so this shows us, again, that maybe those same strategies are happening, but emotion vocabulary, the specific words we're using, is part of how you do that, giving us another potential measure for looking at these types of phenomena in these really naturalistic contexts.
When you talk about diversity of words, is it about really saying, oh, maybe you feel outraged versus infuriated versus angry? Or is it also like exploring kind of a broader emotional space that's not just like a fine-tuned difference, but also going from maybe you feel angry about this, maybe you feel really like you're grieving a situation or you're ashamed. Is it about exploring a big space or is it about granularity within a smaller space, if that makes sense?
That's such a good question. We actually can't answer that with the measure that we have. So the measure we had is just looking at diversity, right? So they could be saying anger, frustration, disappointment. They could be using a lot of sort of words that might cluster together in one space, or they could be using like gratitude and also disappointment and just be all over. Again, we clumped with negative and positive, but they could still be all over the negative space or the positive space. And we don't have a way to look at that. But thinking about it as we talk about it out loud, maybe there's a sort of clustering approach we could take to answer this question of, are they using a lot of words still within the same space, or are they using a lot of words across that negative or positive space? In terms of what I think might be happening, again, we can't say this for sure, but if we think about this sort of specificity story, the idea is that they're able to articulate with more nuance what they're feeling. And so I think that within negative, there's probably a lot of natural clustering that happens anyways. And especially if you think about what kinds of symptoms people are experiencing, if they're experiencing depression symptoms and anxiety symptoms, those are probably clustering. But I think, again, the specificity of how they're using their words is what I think is driving this effect. And if you look at some transcripts, I obviously can't share those, but I did inspect them myself. You'll see that a lot of people who are using really specific language are also really good at articulating their goals for therapy. So they'll come in and they'll say, I'm feeling this and I'm feeling this and I'm working on this and I'm trying to get through this. So they're really intentional. And that actually fits in very nicely with the theory around emotion differentiation and granularity, which suggests that finding these words, why does it matter? Finding the words tells you what you're feeling, which helps you figure out how to fix it. And that you need that foundational sort of knowledge and then putting those experiences into words is what creates a solid enough foundation to then build on it with the correct strategies.
Yeah, that's so interesting.
At least for a negative.
I feel like the temporal dynamics of that are so interesting too, like how you talked about at the very beginning, this idea that maybe at first we want to validate so that we create the safe foundation to maybe get people to reevaluate the situation that they're in without maybe hurting them and without discounting their feelings. That maybe there's a first step where you need to go through, like you need to travel really far in emotional space, and then a next step where you need to narrow it down. That's so interesting.
And just thinking about the temporal dynamics with therapists, they're really literally trained to make sure that they rapport build in the beginning and create space.
Yeah.
And I think sometimes when people hear some of this work, one thought that they have, and I think this is actually stemming from, again, an individual difference. Maybe people who provide reappraisals a lot, when they hear some of this work, they're like, but validation doesn't help anything. You're just doubling down on how they feel. They're just going to ruminate now. And I think that there, sometimes what I like to say is when therapists validate people, they're trained not to just validate your perspective, but to validate your sort of experience, if that makes sense. So just to differentiate what that might look like, you can say, yeah, that guy is such a jerk. Like, he really was wronged you and we should be mad at him. And that's one form of validation where you're focusing on the specific target of the emotion and validating that is the right feeling to have and that person wronged you. Another way to do it that therapists tend to do is to say, it sounds like that was really upsetting for you. I can hear how upset you are, and to describe what they're feeling. So there's one way to do it where you're creating space for them to have the emotions that they're having that isn't necessarily doubling down on the sort of appraisal that they have. And I think that sort of nuanced way that therapists are trained to validate is what helps maybe create that cognitive change down the line.
So interesting. So from all of this, is there anything that we can take away as listeners, consumers of science, in terms of how to be more effective at regulating our friends' emotions or strangers' emotions too?
I think the number one takeaway, first of all, is just that the interactions that we have with other people really leave a mark. They really can help change how they're feeling. They can change the way they're seeing the world around them. Our social interactions are really powerful. And as social psychologists, this is really no surprise, but thinking about this in the emotional context and how much impact it can truly have, I think it's just a reminder that even when you feel like, what can I possibly do for this person? Remember that there's a lot that you could do. You could validate, you could reappraise, you could touch, you could just think about your voice. There are a lot of different things you can say or do. Pull something out of your toolkit and try it. And if it doesn't work, adjust. There's a lot of different things you could try. So just remember that what you do is impactful. There's a lot of different things you could do. That's my sort of takeaway for anyone, for the lay person. And I think in terms of thinking about this for the scientist, I think I encourage people who study emotions and who study just social conversations to start to integrate these two. If you study emotions, think about social interactions. And if you study social interactions, think about emotions. I think that a lot of our interactions are in this middle space of that Venn diagram, and just starting to integrate these things, I think could be really helpful for people. And I'll just say, part of what inspired me to study what I study is I used to be a teacher before grad school for elementary school students. And while I was there, I got to implement a socio-emotional learning curriculum with them. And there we taught them, like, what are emotions? How can you recognize them? Where do they come from? What are some tips for soothing yourself? And they were really receptive. I personally implemented this in a third grade classroom, right? 9-year-olds. And they were amazing at this, malleable at this age. And they learned it very quickly. But I thought what was the most impressive to me and that, like, it truly moved me was to watch how they tried to do this for each other. Right away, I didn't teach them about social emotion regulation. I didn't teach them about social support. I taught them about emotions. And the first thing they did was try to apply it to each other. And it was so sweet and heartwarming. And it was so effective. As a teacher in that classroom, I watched how it built community and built resilience. And so think about all of the different ways that integrating these two streams of research, emotions and social support or social interactions together, could potentially have impacts on broader society.
We've heard about all your amazing work, and you've just inspired everyone to go forth and regulate other people's emotions. But you are starting a lab next year, so just over a year, probably. So what do you want people to know about your lab? What's your vision for it? Do you think you'll be looking for grad students, postdocs? Do you think you're expanding the team?
So I'm still testing out the names of the labs, but right now it's the Social Interactions and Emotion lab. Nice. And I think that makes sense given what I'm studying. And so if you're interested in social interactions and you're interested in emotions, my lab might be a good place for you. I will be recruiting most likely at all levels in meeting lab manager, grad students, and potentially postdocs as well. And in terms of what I want to do, I'm going to continue to do a lot of the work I'm already doing. So if you're really excited about this kind of research, I would love to talk to you. But in terms of future directions and things I'm really excited about, I'll give some like conceptual ideas. So first of all, I'm really excited about the idea of expanding from outside of dyads. So everything I've done is dyads, friend pairs, strangers, clinical therapy. But we don't always do this in dyads. Even within a friend group, you don't always do it one-on-one. Sometimes you rally around a friend and do this together. Sometimes we're co-regulating. We all have things that we need to deal with at the same time. How do we do that? And then I'm also really interested in leaders. So again, this goes back to my teaching experience. How does one person regulate many people with many different personalities, many different styles? How are they effectively regulating a group? And I think here we can think about group dynamics and what's happening between the people who are being regulated collectively. But I think we can also think more about nonverbal cues. So I've mentioned a little bit about acoustics, but I think that when you're regulating for a group, you have to make your message salient. And how do people make their message salient? So this is, again, a sort of overlap between things like social influence and social emotion regulation. How are you starting to do this at a broader level and make sure you have an impact? I'm interested in questions like that. And I'm really interested, again, in integrating new streams of information. I want to look more at acoustics. I want to look more at touch, but I want to also look at facial cues. I want to look at body language, and I want to look at how all of these things in a really naturalistic setting can teach us about how we already are and can be even more effective regulators for others.
Thank you to Dr. Razia Sahi for joining us this episode. Our intro and outro music is Nobody Stayed for the DJ by Glacio. Our transition music is Back for More, also by Glacio.
Minds Matter is created and co-hosted by Beth Fisher, she's the Australian one, and me, Ava Madasuza.
This episode was edited with the help of Malika Morshed and Bhumika Velanani. And you can find social media content on our Instagram at Minds Matter Podcast and TikTok at Minds Matter Pod, created this week by Emily McCandless.
We'll be back in 2 weeks with a brand new episode, but in the meantime, find all our episodes and show notes on MindsMatterPodcast.com.